Welcome back to the program. For 11 years, U.S. foreign policy and even domestic attitudes about our place in the world have been shaped by the reaction to the events of 9/11. But that reaction did not take place in a vacuum. In many ways, as we're coming to learn, the Bush administration's reaction was shaped by what they knew, when they knew it, and what they did about it. Further mistakes made in the 18 months after 9/11 created a kind of alternative universe in which policy was shaped not by real events, but by a perception of reality shaped by repeated mistakes. This is the landscape explored by our guest Kurt Eichenwald in his new book, 500 Days. Kurt Eichenwald is a contributing editor at Vanity Fair and a New York Times best-selling author. He's a two-time winner of the George Polk Award for Excellence in Journalism. He was a Pulitzer Prize finalist, and his book, The Informant, was made into a major motion picture. It is my pleasure to welcome Kurt Eichenwald back to this program to talk about 500 Days, Secrets and Lies in the Terror Wars. Kurt Eichenwald, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Good to have you here. One of the things that happened long before 9/11, when the Bush administration first came to power, you tell the story that Sandy Berger, who was Clinton's national security advisor, said to Condi Rice, "Bin Laden is the one thing you have to watch out for. This is the most important thing." What happened?
Berger's warning was really, this is going to be the thing you deal with the most. You have to look at something in context. The Republicans had been out of the White House for 8 years. When they left, the national security issues of the United States all involved other countries. You know, Iraq, Iran, North Korea, China. And that had been the state of situation for as long as the country had existed. During the 8 years that they were out of power, the emergence of these, you know, what they call non-state actors, these organizations, these terrorist organizations that have, you know, no connection to any particular country, emerged. Al-Qaeda emerged as a true threat. And the idea now wasn't that you have to deal with some official in some palace somewhere or in some office somewhere. Suddenly you're dealing with a bunch of ragtag, dirty guys sitting on a mountaintop in Afghanistan. And the Bush administration in the first 9 months had trouble making that shift, accepting that, you know, the Clinton folks were correct about what was the major threat to national security.
But certainly many of the Bush people, people that came in with the Bush administration, were in various places where they were monitoring what was going on in the world. Some were at RAND, some were at other think tanks. They weren't disconnected from changes in the world entirely.
Yeah, but what you have to, one of the other elements that people overlook, In 2001, when the Bush administration came into power, about 50 people had been killed by bin Laden throughout al-Qaeda's existence. And so to come in and say, this is the huge national security threat, it was, we're talking about, you know, fewer people than die in cars on any day in the United States. I'm not giving excuses. I'm just sort of portraying the mindset and why it was different. There weren't people in senior positions of the administration who were out taking a look at, again, what are called transnational threats, these terrorist groups. They were, in fact, most of the senior people in the Bush administration spent 8 years in an organization that was focused on bringing down the government of Iraq, which obviously emerges as a theme over and over again.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what they saw. I mean, when Bush was being briefed in the months leading up to 9/11, he was being told by the CIA with some degree of specificity that a major attack was coming, that there were people in the United States that were preparing to strike, that there were going to be mass casualties, this was going to be an al-Qaeda attack. The neoconservatives at the Pentagon came in and said, CIA doesn't know what it's talking about. They're being fooled by bin Laden. Bin Laden is playing a game, trying to make us think he's going to attack simply so we take our eyes off of Saddam Hussein. And, you know, it's fitting the intelligence to what you want to believe. But that was a distraction.
this wasn't just one or two or three briefings, as you talk about. We're all familiar with the briefing of August 6th, but as you talk about it, there were 70 previous briefings to that talking about the threat of bin Laden and al-Qaeda.
Well, it's actually worse than that. There were 70 talking about the threat of bin Laden and al-Qaeda, and beginning on May 1st, the direct briefings that went to the president had were detailing a coming specific attack, that something major had been orchestrated by al-Qaeda, that it was coming, and that the government was not ready for it. And, you know, unfortunately, when you had a circumstance, bear in mind, I'm talking like May 1st, they were briefed. In late June, the CIA and the Pentagon are still fighting for the president's attention, with the CIA saying it's al-Qaeda and the Pentagon saying, no, 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 it's Iraq. Which, if you think about it going forward after 9/11, that's kind of the exact same thing that happened again.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we went to Afghanistan and then we went to Iraq.
One of the other places where there were repeated briefings about what the potential danger was at the Justice Department and briefings that took place with Attorney General Ashcroft.
Yes.
Talk about those.
In 500 days, John Ashcroft does not come off well. And, you know, prior to 9/11, on July 5th of 2001, the acting head of the FBI, Mr. Pickard, was giving one of his occasional briefings to Ashcroft, and began telling him again about the information of a coming attack. Now, Pickard says something happened. Ashcroft says it didn't. So what I portray in the book is something that kind of makes it clear who's telling the truth. Because Pickard got up and left that briefing and walked down the hall and went into someone else's office, someone who is of great credibility, you know, the main counterterrorism guy in the FBI, and said, "My God, you're not going to believe what just happened. The Attorney General told me he didn't want to hear anything more about al-Qaeda." And, you know, this is, you know, obviously in the aftermath of this, it's a horrific thing for Ashcroft to face. And again, he wants to say, no, 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 he took it very seriously. But ultimately, he was either, he either did wave off Pickard, or he was unbelievably incompetent. The follow-through, if he believed what he was hearing, if he believed that there was a major attack coming, and then you look at what he did the next few months, he announced his 13 areas of focus for the Justice Department, and terrorism wasn't on it. You had the FBI put in its request for its budget, and its terrorism request was cut back dramatically. They went back to him and said, "We will give up whatever else you want, but give us our terrorism budget back." And Ashcroft agreed to reconsider, and he wrote a letter on September 10th, which was delivered on September 11th and was read on September 12th. And the letter said, "Nope, I'm not going to give you more on terrorism budget. You don't need any more."
Why was Ashcroft, in your view, so adamant in refusing to acknowledge the terrorist threat?
Ashcroft came in. Ashcroft was more than pretty much any attorney general in my lifetime, a very, very political figure. Ashcroft was a senator. He was a senator who got voted out of office. The old famous, he lost to a dead man, mm-hmm. literally. He came into office with a series of things he wanted to accomplish. He wanted to make it easier for people to buy guns. He wanted to, one thing he focused on was making sure that Tim McVeigh got the death penalty. I mean, we're talking about things that were not attorney general level issues, but were policies of, you know, that did not have to do directly with law enforcement. And so when you go down his list of things that were important, you know, it was a lot of it was a political agenda. And that's the problem with having somebody who doesn't have a background in federal law enforcement serving as the Attorney General, or at least have a background in serving as a government lawyer rather than a politician. Terrorism just wasn't something that appealed to him. Terrorism was the thing that happened overseas. Even when we were attacked by Al-Qaeda, it happened overseas. And it was very short-sighted not to recognize that they were coming here.
All of this sets the stage for the fact that when 9/11 did happen, that the administration was not literally taken by surprise, but in fact reminded of all of these briefings, of all of this intelligence, of all of this information. Talk a little bit about the ways in which the foreknowledge of this impacted the immediate reaction to 9/11, as far as the administration is concerned.
Well, the foreknowledge of it was sort of information that was stored up. You know, despite the magnitude of the warnings, there really was not a mindset within the White House of we are going to get hit very soon. We're not stopping it. We're not able to. You know, they have wanted to claim it was impossible for them to do anything. I'm not going to say they could have stopped 9/11, but the same kinds of threats had been raised in the past, and the government reacted differently and did stop potential terrorist attacks. But now, when the attack was there and you had 3,000 people dead on the ground, suddenly the CIA was elevated above all others. Bush asked for everybody's war plans fairly quickly, and the CIA came in with one that they had had on the shelf for years for an invasion of Afghanistan and for taking out Al-Qaeda and taking out the Taliban. And the Pentagon had nothing. And if you think about it, the CIA saying over and over and over and over again, this is the big threat. Sandy Berger, as you mentioned, saying this is the big threat, and the Pentagon doesn't bother to put together a war plan. They put together a war plan for every scenario, but they didn't have one here. And so the CIA was moved to the front of the bus. They were moved into the driver's seat. Bush was very impressed with what they did. And given that they knew it was coming, and Bush knew that they knew it was coming, the CIA grabbed an enormous amount of credibility with the president. And as such, the Afghan war, certainly the first number of months, was straight out of the CIA playbook.
How then did this play into the decisions that started to be made with respect to Iraq and the alleged intelligence about the weapons of mass destruction?
Iraq should never have been on the agenda. The intelligence wasn't there. And there was very strong belief, but I mentioned earlier that the Defense Intelligence Agency had come up with its own analysis about 5 months before the invasion, and said, we don't have good intelligence. We really have nothing. The Iraq group of the CIA was not consulted when the national intelligence estimate that was used to justify the invasion was put together. You had the French saying the intelligence isn't there. You had the Russians saying the intelligence isn't there. Sort of in the same situation where, the CIA saying it's bin Laden, the Pentagon saying, no, it's Saddam Hussein, he's the real threat, they just keep banging that drum. Saddam Hussein is the real threat. And George Bush was done an enormous disservice, possibly the largest in history, of a president being misled by individuals within his own administration who have their own agenda. And their agenda was, as it had been since 1990, as it was for the 8 years of the Clinton administration when they were working with an organization designed to take on Iraq. Their agenda was bring down Iraq. That's what they came into office with. And they utilized 9/11 to justify it. There was no intelligence linking bin Laden to Saddam. It's a ridiculous concept. In 1990, bin Laden declared war on Saddam. And you had, this was a secularist with an Islamic fundamentalist. They don't exactly get along. And so everybody tried to beat that down, everybody who knew better, but they couldn't succeed because, you know, the neoconservatives would pump up some piece of information that would ultimately prove bogus, but it would drive policy for a while. And with that drum being beaten so hard, and with Bush getting this, if we don't do something, you know, bin Laden's going to bring a bomb, you know, a nuclear bomb from Iraq into New York City and kill everybody, I mean, Bush was rightfully terrified. Bush was rightfully concerned about what this was. And so based on the information he was getting, you know, you can understand the direction he was going. He should have questioned it more thoroughly.
Except that the CIA, which had proven to be so accurate in the run-up to 9/11, was saying that this intelligence was flawed, that they didn't have intelligence to support it. And the other point you make is that right after 9/11, the tremendous cooperation from the international community, the Russians, the Libyans, even the Syrians, seeking to cooperate, all of whom said that there was no indication that Saddam Hussein had anything to do with it or had the weapons of mass destruction.
Right, but when the CIA didn't produce the evidence that the neoconservatives in the Pentagon and the vice president's office wanted, the Pentagon and the vice president's office set up their own intelligence unit. And that intelligence unit was feeding information through on its own to George Bush. And that intelligence unit was taking bits and pieces of information, much of it had already been disproven, and repeating it. And when the CIA said this isn't true, the answer was, well, we disagree. And so, you know, it's to sort of adapt an old phrase, they had a hammer, so everything was a nail. They had the desire to go into Iraq, and so every possible motive was a motive to go into Iraq. Every possible piece of information was proof of Iraq. You know, there was the UN weapon inspectors who went back in 2002, led by Hans Blix. When Blix came back, was not finding anything, the response of the Bush administration was to attack him, you know, call him incompetent, call him, being fooled by Saddam. And Blix was the single best bit of intelligence the American government had on Iraq, because he was there. He was on the ground. He was going place to place. He was not saying, gee, there's nothing there. He was saying, here's something that was troubling, here's something that was troubling, but we have not encountered this yet, weapons of mass destruction. Rather than utilizing that intelligence, and this was a technique of the Bush administration that was really very, very self-defeating, they just attacked him. They went after the messenger and then ignored the intelligence. And you saw that over and over and over again. When they got information they didn't like, they attacked the messenger. When people remember Valerie Plame, mm-hmm. the CIA agent who was outed by the Bush White House because her husband had come back checking into an Iraq allegation about Saddam Hussein getting yellow cake uranium from Niger. Well, the story was completely bogus. And, you know, everyone now knows it was completely bogus. And that gentleman wrote something saying, it's completely bogus. And so rather than go, well, let's look at this intelligence, the response of people in the White House was, well, let's go after him. And they went after him by going after his wife and suggesting that he wasn't qualified, and the only reason he was sent to Niger was because his wife and the CIA had arranged for him to have this wonderful boondoggle, and nobody ever intended to listen to anything he had to say, all of which was a lie, and all of which was a crime, because Valerie Plame, who they exposed, was she could not be identified. She could not legally be identified as working for the CIA without violating the law. And so when you have people who don't want to hear, don't want to know, are willing to mislead the president, are willing to manufacture and manipulate their own intelligence, their own, you know, intelligence information to create a scenario, to cut people out, I mean, you're going to go to war. And, you know, I don't know how they sleep at night.
One of the more shocking aspects of this, beyond all this, that sort of brings it into bold relief, is that when George Bush is trying to put the coalition together and talks to French President Chirac, his case is not based upon evidence or information. It's based on this idea that he tells Chirac that somehow it's a divine purpose in doing this.
Bush had many conversations with Chirac, and the one you're referring to, he was jumping all over the place. He was talking about, you know, we have to prove that we're willing to be united, if, you know, so that Saddam will know we're serious. We have to do these things so that otherwise the UN will lose influence. He was going topic to topic to topic. And Chirac didn't think the intelligence was any good, and that's what he was making his decision on. He didn't have a bunch of people feeding him bogus information. He was working off of the actual intelligence that the French had and reviewing what the Americans had and wasn't persuaded by it. And so Bush is not succeeding much with Chirac, and he suddenly says, you know, Jacques, you and I, you're a Catholic, I'm a Methodist, but we're both Christians, and Gog and Magog is coming into play, and this confrontation is willed by God. Biblical prophecies are being fulfilled. And as you might imagine, Chirac is horrified. But he gets off the phone. He has no idea what Bush was talking about. He mentioned this thing, Gog and Magog. And so they hire an expert on the Bible who works in a university in Switzerland. And he writes a report about Gog and Magog and how what that means is, you know, it's two things out. It's one, it's out of the book of Ezekiel and the book of Revelation, and it pertains to Armageddon. And so Chirac reviewed this report and decided that he thought Bush was a fanatic, and that, you know, there was absolutely no, you know, he already had doubts of the intelligence. There was absolutely no way he was going to bring his country into war when he had reason to believe that part of the decision was being driven by the president's interpretation of the Bible.
How did Tony Blair, who should have known better, try and square this circle?
Well, Tony Blair is a complicated case because Tony Blair was a true believer, and he did believe that there were weapons of mass destruction. The people working with him didn't all believe it. And Blair's decision was based on a very logical thing, which is that Saddam Hussein threw the weapons inspectors out in 98. And then it's like, well, if you throw the weapons inspectors out, you know, what is your motivation for doing so? But he also was not as careful. It was a decision, you know, I believe this, but he clearly did believe it, you know, on his own. But he also believed that Bush, that Cheney was very bad for Bush, that Rumsfeld was very bad for Bush, and that the president was being led astray, and the president was being put into a position where, you know, if he did what Cheney wanted the administration to do, that the United States would become completely alienated from the international community. So, you know, at one point he says, my to one of his aides, my role is, I don't remember the exact words, but it's essentially to keep them grounded in reality, to make sure that, they handle these things within the realm of reality. And what comes out in 500 days is that Tony Blair played a major role in negotiating through the turf wars and difficulties within the Bush administration. I mean, he went head to head with Dick Cheney at a meeting right in front of George Bush, and he won. And so he was able to persuade Bush to take more of an international attempt position, to go through the UN, to try to build a coalition. Cheney didn't want to do any of that. Cheney thought the UN was useless, thought the idea of giving weapons inspectors time was ridiculous, and he just wanted the United States to go in and launch a war, and that would be that.
Part of the story of the 500 days is truly this alternative universe that starts to emerge, that one bad decision is made on top of another with misinformation, on top of another with misinformation, to a point where it's hard to even begin to peel back to the state of reality.
Events are moving so quickly, and people are deceiving themselves, people are getting false information, people are getting bad information, people are getting good information. Problem is, how do you tell one from the other? And so you end up with excellent decisions, you end up with terrible decisions. Sometimes when I was talking earlier about the whole they don't like what you're saying, they attack you, I've already started experiencing that. I've had members of the Bush administration come out and say, well, if I'm not saying they were perfect, then obviously, I'm trying to, I must be a partisan and I'm lying and I'm part of the conspiracy theories. And it's the same kind of garbage. And none of these people have read the book. And so when you have that mindset where it's, the initial reaction is to say anybody who even suggests we're not perfect, we're not going to even consider what they're saying, you're going to make horrific mistakes. Nobody has a monopoly on truth. And the idea that they could go through and just be on their own and not adapt to criticism was a huge downfall. Guantanamo, to throw an example out there, Guantanamo was a necessary thing. It didn't have to be Guantanamo, but you had to put these detainees someplace. And you couldn't pour them into the criminal system because, this were not criminal activities. This was a war. And so when you put Guantanamo together, well, okay, that's what you have to deal with. It was handled incredibly incompetently. You had the interrogation system that was put in place. Was terrible. And this is not me saying this. I've interviewed a ton of people who were at Guantanamo and officers there, mm-hmm. and people running the place. And universally, it's like it was a disaster. It was an absolute disaster. You had 19-year-olds who were being thrown into the room with 48 hours of training to question some hardened terrorist. And they signaled right off the bat they didn't know that what they were doing, because every one of them had been instructed when you start talking with one of these guys, you establish authority and you scream at him, "Where's Bin Laden?" Well, it would be like if I walked up to you and screamed, "Where's the Secretary of State?" It's like, how would you know? and it's not like everybody in Afghanistan and Pakistan was walking along with their, "I am directly linked to Bin Laden" button. And so that signaled that we didn't know what we were doing. The security systems were terrible. And over time, that got fixed. But it took a lot longer than it should have because when people came in and said, this is bad, they were attacked. And it's the same thing. It was just very, very foolish management of reality.
Kurt Eichenwald, the book is 500 Days, Secrets and Lies and the Terror Wars. It's just out from Touchstone. Kurt, I thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thanks for having me.